Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kesbarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, and welcome to this Federal Society webinar call. Today, September 28th, 2023, we're excited to host a litigation update on Bates versus Pact Arrest, a case concerning the Oregon Department of Human Services rules for potential adoptive parents, free speech, and free exercise. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an assistant director of practice groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I'll keep my introductions of our guests today incredibly brief. But if you'd like to know more, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Jonathan Scruggs, who is Vice President of Litigation Strategy and the Director of the Center of Conscience Initiatives at the Alliance Defending Freedom, and the lead attorney representing Jessica Bates, the Bates in this case. Mr. Scruggs has been with ADF since 2006 and is a member of the bars of Arizona and Tennessee, and he is also admitted to the U.S. Supreme Court and multiple federal district and appellate courts. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Miles Coleman, who is a partner at Nelson, Mullins, Riley, and Scarborough LLP, where he practices in the areas of appellate law, business litigation, and First Amendment law. He is also an NFL Players Association certified agent. I'll leave it there. As a last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screens, so that they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for being with us today. Mr. Coleman, the floor is yours.
All right. Thanks very much. Welcome, everyone. We're pleased to be here today. I think we'll have an interesting discussion, and I hope you think so as well. John, welcome. Thanks for being here with us today. I know that in the course of your work at ADF, and especially with the conscience rights team that you lead there, you've worked on some cases that I know we've all heard of: Masterpiece Cake Shop, 303 Creative recently, Brush and Nib, and some other cases. We want to talk to you about one that you're working on right now, the Bates case, as we've already heard, at a super high level, which has to do with a woman seeking to become a foster or adoptive parent in Oregon, and who's run into some obstacles that are related to her faith. What we'll plan to do, if this sounds okay to you and everybody else, we'll spend maybe 10 or 12 minutes kind of talking about the facts of the case, make sure we understand the facts, the procedural posture where it's at. Then we'll pivot to talk about some of the legal issues related to it. And then, of course, we'll save some time at the end for questions from the audience. Why don't we start with this? I've had an opportunity over the past decade or so to do some foster and adoptive care work, legal work myself, sometimes on constitutional issues, but sometimes not. And one thing that I have found to be consistently true in all of those different contexts was the folks who are serving children in need have just such a deep sense of calling to do it. So let's start by talking a little bit about your client, Jessica Bates. Who is she? Why does she want to foster or adopt? Just tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, Miles, a lot of the people you interact with here are really inspirations. And I think that's definitely true of our client. She has a pretty inspirational story, but somewhat of a tragic story in a sense too. So in 2017, she was driving with her husband to work. She lives in Oregon, and it was a snowstorm, I believe. And she got collided head on with someone in a car, actually someone who had been earlier released. It was part of a mental institution, a state mental institution, was released by the state. And earlier that day had stabbed, I believe, his ex-wife. So he was running from the police and head on collided with Jessica and her husband. Her husband died, and Jessica was injured substantially and basically left to raise her five children, which obviously is an enormous tragedy. But her church family, her community came around her, supported her. So numerous years later, she was just going to work and was listening to a religious broadcast on the radio and heard about a story of a man who fostered. And she felt called and convicted after hearing that story to adopt herself. So she wanted to adopt two children under the age of nine. Her youngest child at the time was about 10. So she wanted to adopt someone younger than her youngest child. So someone under the sibling pair under the age of 9. She initially looked to do some international adoption, but that was prohibitively expensive. So eventually wound up going through the state process in Oregon. So she really decided to adopt for purely religiously. She'll tell you that she felt called, you know, there's a Bible verse in James that talks about how God calls people to care for orphans and widows. And she felt convicted and inspired that in the same way she felt like that God had helped her through the death of her husband, that she was being called to help others in need. And that was her religious motivation for starting that process.
Okay. And was she seeking, I don't know if in Oregon it's considered a licensure or accreditation or some sort of state imprimatur of her ability to participate in the program? Is that generally?
Yes, that's right. You can adopt a foster in kind of numerous ways, and it varies from state to state. In Oregon, you can go through an independent agency, but that still has to be approved at the end of the day by the state. But she went directly to the state. She went to the Department of Human Services and started, essentially, you have to get licensed by the state to foster and then adopt.
Okay. And typically, at least in my experience, that licensure process is going to involve a background check. The fire marshal comes out to make sure that your house is, you know, you get fire alarms and fire extinguishers and that sort of thing. I'm going to assume, but perhaps that she passed all of those requirements, but she ran into a hurdle at some point. Talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. So she actually ran into a hurdle pretty quickly. So the first stage, you kind of apply and go through what's called a home study. And that kind of, you get some training information and the state evaluates you. Basically, are you fit to be in the process? You know, there are various boxes you have to check. You have to go through training. And then if you pass that initial stage, they will do a home inspection, right? That officials will come home, interview your current children, interview family and friends, interview you, to make sure that, you know, everything is good. And then it goes through really the matching process, right? Just because you become eligible, then you got to decide, okay, what's the best fit for a particular child. So Jessica started that process and she was going through with no trouble, starting that home study. And she went through the training of it. And you know, during that training, they present various like your Alleghenal issues and whatnot. And in that training, there is a heavy emphasis on how to relate to children who identify as gay or, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity issues. And in fact, in the training, it was said that, well, you have to use children's professed pronouns, consistent with their gender identity, whether within their biological sex. You have to be willing, for example, to take a child to a gay pride festival, that you can't take a child to events that are not supportive of their sexual orientation, gender identity, for example, such as it singled out religious events. So she went through that training and that kind of raised some concerns for her because of her religious beliefs. So she then reached out to her kind of contact at the state in the process and said, hey, I just want to be clear. The program was great. I can love and accept and support any child that you put in my home, but I can't support these behaviors I disagree with, such as using a child's preferred pronoun that contradicts their biological sex, or take a child to go get hormone shots to facilitate a gender transition. Then the official called back and they talked about that. And the official raised that point about, well, you know, this is a problem. Will you be willing to take a child, you know, to get hormone shots? And she said, no, I can't, you know, I can't do those things. And she emphasized, hey, I mean, I'm seeking a child, 2 children under the age of 9, any child, you know, an infant, for example, the age of 1 or 2. But the official was like, well, we just don't know who will eventually identify as gay or identify as a different gender. So we can't, you know, approve. So she eventually got that denial letter from the state that said, that acknowledged that she would be willing to accept any child and love any child, but she failed to comply with a provision that says basically someone has to be willing to accept, support, and respect a child's race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, spiritual beliefs, things along those lines. So basically, Oregon interprets that to say you've got to be willing, even if it violates your religious beliefs, to do those type of things.
Do you know, I might be kind of jumping ahead of myself here, and I think you're not into the discovery phase, the proceeding yet, but do you know, and the reason I'm asking this, I'm analogizing to South Carolina. In South Carolina, once you're licensed by the state, for example, as a foster parent, even then when there's going to be a match, even when, and again, in our case, DSS, Department of Social Services, has a child in need for placement, there is both an obligation at the match stage, at the placement stage, both on the state agency and the right of the licensed foster parent to decline a match, right? So, for example, if the state has a child whose family of origin is Jewish and who wish for the child to be placed in a Jewish home, the state is obliged to try, if at all possible, to honor that request of parents. Meanwhile, the foster home could say, no, we're in a really busy season right now. We aren't able to take a child. I bring that up just because I'm curious because, you know, you touched on the point that, you know, Jessica was specifically looking for younger children. And just wondering if part of the issue flagged by the state is both perhaps an unlikely issue, relatively speaking, the younger the child is, and could in fact perhaps be prevented entirely by licensing her and then just working on it at the matching stage. If that from a regulatory standpoint is how it works and
that's exactly right. And that's one of our big arguments here, that you can resolve a lot of these issues at the matchment stage later on rather than up front. So as you know, DISCO requested, and they allow that, to request a child based on certain age. And you can even do that based on sex. You can even, you know, request children if you feel uncomfortable, I think, based on disability, right? So you can imagine a scenario, right, where a family has all boys and, you know, they need to have another boy just for physical accommodations in their house. So yes, there are all these exceptions, and that goes to what we'll talk about as our free exercise argument, that if the state can make these exceptions in other contexts, they can make it for Jessica. And it even goes beyond that. I mean, I think just logically, you know, think about religious, spiritual values, cultural beliefs, right? Like, it wouldn't make much sense. You could have a Muslim family, right? Or you're not forcing them to promote Catholicism if a child is Catholic, or to do something along those lines, right? Or, you know, along with cultural beliefs, it could be like some type of, you know, a Jewish family has certain rules about food. You know, how do you square that? And all of these issues we feel like are best resolved at the matching stage later on, you know, put the right child with the right family rather than exclude someone up front.
Okay, so, and I kind of got us a little bit off track there in terms of the chronological sequence of things, but let me get back on the tracks. So Jessica applied, had this training event. There was a subsequent, sounds like correspondence back and forth between her and the agency. At what point did she decide to seek legal representation? How did she get connected to you? How did you and ADF get involved in the case? And then when and where did you sort of take your next steps?
Yeah, so actually she got this formal denial letter, and that, again, to emphasize, that means she could no longer foster or adopt any child. Like, she was excluded per se from the system. And so she just reached out to us. We have an intake system, and she reached out to us because we're well known as people who defend religious liberty. And we just started that process of evaluating her case. So she got denied, I think, I have to go back and look at the dates, the end of 2022. And then we filed a lawsuit, I think it was April of 2023. And with our complaint, we kind of pulled into the procedural posture. With our complaint, we filed a motion for a preliminary injunction simultaneously with the complaint, then had to brief that. That took a bit of a time. and we had oral arguments before the district court judge. We filed in the district court of Oregon, and we had oral argument on the preliminary injunction in August. And so we're really waiting. That's the latest thing that's happened. We're just kind of waiting for the judge to decide that motion.
Okay. And I'm assuming, but correct me if I'm wrong, your complaint is seeking declaratory and injunctive relief. And I assume mediatory action, attorney's fees, upon success, any other requested?
No, we're not seeking any type of damages or anything along those lines. It's purely declaratory and injunctive relief, just to give Jessica back access to start the process.
And the same for the motion for PI, is that would just be, I guess, from a practical standpoint, what would be the injunctive remedy at the PI stage?
Yeah, it would just be, again, to allow her to access the program, to start the process where she ended off.
Okay.
And that's really important, because the ultimate relief we're seeking is not to have Jessica adopt or foster a specific child at the end of the day. It's really just to access this program on an equal basis as others. And, you know, her kids are getting older. She has five kids. And some are, you know, eventually will start to go to college, and she wants to start that program, because it could take a while, you know, to match with the right child. So time is ticking in some respects.
Okay. The complaint you mentioned a second ago, you got a complaint filed, you've briefed and argued, motion for PI hasn't been decided, motions to dismiss or answers yet.
There was an answer filed, so no motion to dismiss. So we're definitely going to go to discovery. I think both sides are really kind of waiting on to see what the judge does, the preliminary injunction decision, to maybe give people guidance.
Yeah. Okay. In the complaint, what claims, what causes of action have you asserted?
We've asserted three claims: free speech, free exercise, and equal protection. I'll probably focus mostly on the free speech and free exercise. The equal protection is similar to our free exercise. But for this free speech, it's simple. It's primarily both compelled speech and restricted speech, to get to the point of, and also association along the same lines there. That basically conditioning Jessica's access to the program to force her to use pronouns that violate her core convictions compels her to speak, saying that she can't take her child to various religious events like her church or going to a youth group, or can't explain her religious beliefs about gender identity or sexual orientation. It violates her religious speech rights. So that's kind of, I think, pretty basic. For the free exercise, it's similar. We rely really heavily on the fact that there are all these exceptions that we talked about. So that makes the law, the provision, not neutral, generally applicable, because the state can grant these other exemptions. And when you talk about some of those, for example, independent adoptions, there's a mechanism for, in fact, I think most people go through what's called independent adoptions, is, you know, often a biological parent will adopt, allow, you know, a different relative to adopt without going through the foster care per se system. And the state sometimes requires those families to do a home study, which submit the requirement, follow the requirements that they imposed on Jessica, but sometimes they waive that. And so that creates an individualized assessment under the Fulton case. We mentioned some of those other exceptions about, well, you can, you know, ask a child for a particular age or a particular, you know, religion, things along those lines. That creates exceptions that make the law lack general applicability. So that's our free exercise argument. And then, like I said, we didn't bring the equal protection argument in the motion for preliminary injunction. But one of the arguments there is Trinity Lutheran, which says you can't condition the benefit on religious status, also is an equal protection type argument too, because, you know, religious status is a protected class under the equal protection clause.
Okay.
So those are the kind of the general arguments that I highlight.
All right, well, let's back up, because I got questions.
Yeah, I love that.
And hopefully you got answers. We'll find out.
Yeah.
So this is a fact pattern. When you sort of first hear it, first read it, even at a pretty high level, right off the bat, you think free exercise and you think equal protection. You don't, or at least I don't. I like to think I at least have a little bit of dipped a toe in these waters before. You don't think association, assembly, And maybe you don't immediately think speech. So I've got a couple of questions there. First, that's your first cause of action. Why'd you lead off with that?
Well, I think it's just, the Supreme Court has been pretty protective and really frowning on compelled speech situations and free speech in generally. And, we think it's an important principle to protect free speech. And one of our arguments in this case is, this in some ways is broader than just religious persons, right? Excluding a group of people for holding certain views, for speaking certain views the government disagrees with, is pretty problematic. And I think this is an example of that. Litigation wise, you don't have to go through the process, as every litigator knows, in every free exercise case, you have to encounter, Smith, Employment Division versus Smith. So you can don't have to worry with that and go right to a compelled speech, free speech analysis. And so we think we're on pretty strong grounds there. As you mentioned, 303 Creative, I think is very helpful. And that came up at the preliminary injunction hearing. So it is broader than just religion in these types of cases. And I note that I think it's pretty unusual. The reason it probably hasn't come up, I think there are a lot of free speech issues that have come up in the custody context. You can imagine where, a Muslim dad or someone, a mom who converts to Catholicism, how do you handle who has custody over a child and what religious events they can go to, what speaking events. You've even seen courts in family law context impose type of prior restraints on what can be said in various situations. So it has come up in the custody context, but pretty rare in the foster adoption context. And I think that's just because it's kind of a common sense thing of why impose a per se rule, right? On, hey, you've got to say this message you disagree with. You can't say this message. Again, you think that would be able to be handled at the matching stage rather than up front. So anyway.
Let me ask another one on the compelled speech and bear with me. So it's going to take me a second to tee this up, because I got to explain two cases. I'm going to assume that anybody who's spending an hour of their lunch break listening to two nerds talk about the Constitution is probably familiar with these cases. But nevertheless, I just want to make sure that everybody's track along with us. So you're talking about compelled speech, right? Seminal case on compelled speech, Woolley v. Maynard. George Maynard doesn't want to live, free, or die on his license plate. He snips it off. He gets arrested. He goes to jail. Goes to the Supreme Court. Say, no, the state can't force you to be a mobile billboard driving around. Okay, that's compelled speech. That's not exactly what this is. And I'm gonna push back on you here a little bit. That's not quite what this is. This feels, or could seem, I'm not going to stake out a position on myself, but it could seem to be more like a case that maybe people are less familiar with, Rust v. Sullivan, a more recent case than Woolley v. Maynard. Federal HHS has these grants, right? So we've got money going out. At least in that case, it had to do with restricting the grant recipient's ability to talk about abortion, basically, to refer or that sort of thing. And that's a gross oversimplification of the case. The Supreme Court said, in that case, Rust v. Sullivan, that restriction is okay. Essentially, and again, I'm greatly oversimplifying the case for the sake of time, because that's the government's message and that's the government's money going to you. So we got Maynard on the one hand. It seems like Rust v. Sullivan, different result, different set of facts. Looking at this set of facts, why is this not more like Rust v. Sullivan as opposed to Woolley v. Maynard, which is, I think, what you're saying. It's compelled speech. I don't know if I tee that up quite clearly enough, but hopefully at least get the gist of what I'm after.
Sure. I think that's one of the interesting questions in this case is, what is the standard that you use? And we would say, one thing, Oregon actually didn't even raise that line of cases in their response. And I think the simple reason is, in subsequent cases, one being Mattel versus Tom, which involved a trademark case, and the government raised that same type of argument of like, hey, this is kind of a subsidy, government funding, it's this line of cases. And the Supreme Court, at least in that case, it seemed to be everyone agreed that no, in that trademark situation, we're not giving you any money. There's no money here. It's not a spending clause type issue. And that's the same. Oregon is not giving Jessica any money. It's more like a license to do something than giving her money. So it kind of falls outside of that government funding type scenario. Now, I note that even in the government funding cases that you have case law saying you can't compel speech, there's various different tests, right? Like, is the is the requirement germane to the, you know, to the program? But we think we fall under Mattel, we fall outside that line of cases. And I think that's one reason why Oregon didn't even raise that line of cases, because there's just no funding here to condition just gone. You know, Oregon, I think, has over 1,000, they give out license in 1,000 different situations. You can go to their website. You know, LLCs have to get licensed, charities have to get licenses. So it's a bit more of that situation, and more similar to 303. That was one of the arguments made in 303 Creative. It's like, hey, you have to, you go into business, you have to get licensed by the state, therefore you give up your First Amendment rights. And I don't think that's accurate. So, but interesting enough, Oregon, rather than raise those line of cases, raised a separate line of cases saying, well, this is conduct, not speech at all, because you're like a licensed professional, that you're kind of like a lawyer or a doctor. And it cited this case called Tingley versus Ferguson, which is a case my firm is involved in as well, a licensed counselor. Can the state basically regulate, you know, what goes on in the counseling office and say, hey, you can provide this counseling, not that counseling? Is that speech or is that conduct? And we don't think that's the right line of cases either. First of all, I think that case is wrong after the NIFLA decision. But even applying, taking that case as is, that case only applied to kind of a licensed professional. And of course, Jessica isn't like a licensed parent professional. You know, parents are just parents. And the state can't regulate, you know, in that situation in Tingley, the argument was, well, this is a medical procedure. That was the state's argument. And that's obviously nothing like that going on here. Because again, the state excluded her from engaging in any type of a religious conversation. They categorically appeared up front and said, you know, you can't go to any religious event effectively. You have to use these preferred pronouns. Parenting involves speech, as I think all of us parents know. So we think it goes right to the core of the First Amendment.
And I guess one factual clarification question to tease out something you said. I guess because Jessica is applying for licensure as an adoptive parent, that's probably going to be a factually different scenario than if she was applying to serve as a foster parent, in which case there could be some sort of per diem payment or per month payment for the foster child's board, room, upkeep, and that sort of thing. So I guess first, am I right in understanding she's applying for the former, not the latter?
Yes. I mean, she's applying to adopt, right? And I think it varies whether foster families do get what type of, you know, monetary relief they get. But yeah, she is definitely applying to be an adopted family. But there have been cases involving foster situations where courts have applied what I call standard First Amendment scrutiny, right? Obviously, there's the Fulton case involving their Catholic adoption agency, but there's even been cases involving individuals, a case out of Washington a year or so ago called Blaze versus Hunter, which is a very similar fact pattern. Except in that situation, it was foster. But again, it was the great grandparents of a child wanting to adopt that child. And they wanted to first foster and then adopt. So that's pretty much a similar fact pattern. And the court there ruled that said Washington's system violated free exercise, didn't rule on the free speech arguments, but ruled on the free exercise arguments and said, this system is really riddled with exceptions and exemptions. And so it lacks general application. So we obviously draw that line of cases to say, this is just like a licensure system. Just because you have to get your license from the state doesn't mean you give up your First Amendment rights.
Yeah, that makes sense. One thing you mentioned Fulton a second ago, this was not mentioned, the money aspect, the funding aspect was not mentioned, I don't think at all, in any of the Supreme Court's opinions in Fulton. But if you look back at the lower court opinions, and certainly in the party's briefing, there were enormous amounts of funding at issue related to Catholic Social Services licensure, millions of dollars. And all because they were one of the largest, oldest, most award-winning agencies, and everybody else was getting this funding. And I think that's a relevant point. I think also, even in the foster context, which again, admittedly is not what Jessica is seeking, those board payments, and this picks up on a point you made a little bit ago, those board payments have a specific purpose. And it has nothing to do with funding the parents speaking or funding the parents life outside of the role of fostering, but those payments are for food, additional utilities, all that sort of thing. So, which again, I think is distinguishable from Rust, where the money in that case was for a specific purpose, and the speech restriction was intimately and unmistakably tied to that purpose. So I think that's a relevant distinction you make there too. Let me ask a couple questions on your free exercise claim, and I do want to keep enough time. I know we've got some questions coming in. I want to save some time for those at the end. But so you've got this free exercise claim. I mean, walk us through that. The state isn't forcing her to change her beliefs. It's not forcing her to believe something she doesn't believe. It's not forcing her to abstain from going to her church. How is this impinging on her freedom to exercise her religious beliefs?
Yeah, there's just a long line of cases going back 50, maybe longer years, the Supreme Court basically says you can't condition a benefit in a way that violates the free exercise clause. So whether it be the Thomas case or really Sherbert, which involved unemployment benefits, but also Fulton is a good example of that, right? Fulton was a contract. That was one of the arguments made at the Supreme Court. It's like, hey, this is a contract. We're not forcing you to violate your religious beliefs. This is not a restriction. You willingly enter into this contract and therefore, no harm, no foul type things. And the court says, no, you can't condition a benefit on violating your religious beliefs. The unconstitutional conditions doctrine has similar principles going on. So, you can't, and then that's also Trinity Lutheran line of cases. In that situation, the government had a program that basically said anyone can apply to provide, playground material to resurface your playgrounds. Their church applied and they excluded, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. Obviously, we're talking about play, in one sense, we're talking about playgrounds, but again, you can't condition a benefit like that in a way that violates, someone's religious beliefs. So at the end of the day, our ultimate argument, which brings in these equal protection principles, is Jessica is essentially seeking to have equal access to this program. Again, she's not seeking the right to eventually adopt a particular child. She's just asking for the right to access this program on an equal basis as others. So it goes to those kind of equal treatment principles.
And I don't know if you've made this argument, but it seems like that the free exercise piece of it is particularly compelling here, where Jessica's religious beliefs and exercise are not merely tangential to the licensure she's seeking. Like from the way you were kind of talking, they are literally the reason she is seeking this licensure. And I'm guessing, again, based on sort of your articulation of her story, and she heard this, felt this motivation, the Bible reference from James about caring for the widow and orphans and those in distress. I'm guessing that in fact, what she is doing here is itself an exercise of her religious beliefs.
No, absolutely, and I think that goes to the point of that's true for many people, right? Many people who are serving in the foster adoption care system are religiously motivated to do so, and it would, to cut off this large population, obviously it hurts the people of faith, but it hurts the kids at the end of the day, right? I mean, there are, as I noted, or maybe I didn't know, there are about 400,000 kids across America in the foster adoption system. In Oregon, I think last year it was about 8,000 kids who need a loving home. So if you exclude parents up front because of their religious beliefs about certain things, you're hurting the kids, you're hurting them. And again, a lot of these issues can be addressed at the matching stage. To highlight the point, under Oregon's theory, she's totally excluded. So she couldn't, adopt a child at her own church. Let's say what a member of her own church wanted to put up a child for adoption. She couldn't be eligible to adopt them. Which makes little sense. Why would you exclude Jessica from adopting a child who shared her own religious beliefs on various matters?
But that it also has sort of a perverse effect on the children in the system and their families, to the extent that a child, which again, that could be anyone up to 18 years old, that let's say there's a child who himself or herself is a devout evangelical Christian or his family of origin is, and they really, really want to be placed with a like-minded foster or adoptive home. Sounds like the Oregon system is excluding the type of home that those children or those families of origin want to go to.
Yeah, exactly. And so it makes little sense. Why treat religion on that score differently than cultural belief or some other belief, right? You can match children and families on the back end to put them in the best place possible for these other reasons and other beliefs. You have to do that for religious beliefs.
Yeah. And I think it bears noting too that, you know, in this case, Jessica's a evangelical Christian, attends a non-denominational church, but that same faith motivating impetus is true of other faith communities as well. I know both in the Jewish tradition, in the Muslim tradition, and others, there is a religious compulsion, even an obligation that folks can feel to serve others of their faith community and just the community more generally in that way.
Absolutely.
And leaving those players on the bench, forcing them to stay on the bench and not letting them get in the game, sure doesn't seem like it's in the best interest of literally anyone involved.
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense to me. So I feel like we have a compelling case, but I'm biased, you know, and I think our free exercise argument is pretty compelling. I think our free speech argument, because again, goes to that point of even people with no faith who hold certain beliefs. Do we want to empower the state to categorically exclude somebody because of some political belief, for example? You know, we make the comparison of, well, you know, Oregon can seriously consider a more liberal state might hold certain beliefs, but, you know, a conservative state might hold different beliefs and try to exclude someone. Might try to, for example, say, you can't use pronouns consistent with a child's gender identity, or you can't teach children about, you know, your beliefs about CRT, and therefore are you categorically excluded from the foster adoption system. There has to be some type of scrutiny there to evaluate that as well, you know, analyze that under the free speech clause.
Do you have any sense, and if you don't, that's fine, because this would be a difficult and maybe even to some extent impossible question to answer, but do you have any sort of a sense, even if anecdotally, how many other people who are in Jessica's shoes, and let's say in Oregon, right? You mentioned, I think, about 8,000 kids who, whether for a day or longer, but I think if I'm hearing you right, around 8,000 unique children who pass through that system at some point per year. Do you have any sense from a numbers standpoint, the exclusionary effect that Oregon's system is having at present?
I don't have the sense of numbers. I mean, we haven't hit discovery yet. I will say that we have been contacted by people across the country. So Oregon's system is not the only rule like this. There's a, like I mentioned earlier, Washington had a similar rule and they were sued and lost in federal court. There's a similar lawsuit going on in Massachusetts right now, somewhat similar set of facts. So there are people across the country, and I would suggest as people contact us, right? If you're being excluded because your faith. So it is going on the flip side, most states can accommodate this. Actually, in Jessica's case, numerous states filed an amicus brief in support of our argument led by the state of Idaho. And one of their arguments was essentially, hey, we don't require this. You don't have to, which goes really to our strict scrutiny analysis, right? That there are other ways to do this. We just handle it at the matching phase. We don't exclude people because of their religious beliefs up front. So you see that divergence of practices by states.
Well, and I'll tell you, it's not risk-free to accommodate religious agencies and religious believers in that system. The two cases I've got in South Carolina, where I represent Governor McMaster and our State Department of Social Services, it's kind of the inverse. Right? In this instance, the state did accommodate a religious agency who, as a matter of religious belief, wanted to work only with co-religionists, and they would gladly refer any other applicants to one of 20 plus other agencies in the state. And as a result of that accommodation, a number of out-of-state public interest groups have come in, sued the governor, sued federal HHS, sued state DSS, claiming what I believe is a fairly implausible establishment clause claim. But we've had summary judgment motions pending for about 6 months now. We'll find out if the court finds them similarly implausible as I do. Let me use that as kind of a segue. And you touched on this a second ago. I don't know if the right analogy is sort of a mosaic of cases that's starting to emerge, a pattern, a quilt, maybe a patchwork quilt, is starting to emerge in this context over the last probably 5 years or so in a way that really hadn't previously. There's obviously a 200-year history of private and faith-based individuals and entities participating in foster and adoption work. But really, it's just in the last handful of years that it started to develop its own body of precedent. Fulton, we've talked about a little bit. I just kind of mentioned the two cases I've got in South Carolina. You mentioned Hunter v. Blaze, which I think was in Washington State.
That's right. It was in federal court in Washington State.
Okay. You mentioned the Massachusetts case that was recently filed. I think that's also in federal court. Some of your colleagues at ADF had a Northern District of New York case not too long ago, went to the Second Circuit. And I think there's a case in Tennessee in state court in which a Jewish couple has sued the state regarding its accommodation of a Christian agency. So that I wasn't counting there, but that's six or eight sort of data points. I guess, how do you see the case we're here to talk about, Bates? How does that sort of fit within this mosaic pattern that we're starting to see emerging? And then do you have any sense of what will be the next set of questions? If Fulton was sort of the first set of questions, the licensure of an agency, and now we're on to sort of what we might think of as generation two questions, Blaze, your case, Bates, the licensure of individuals. And sorry, this would be a terrible trial examination. I've just asked you like seven questions all at once, and then I'll throw it to you. But I guess where do you see this going next as we look ahead to the next few years?
I mean, I think a lot of the heat, you know, Fulton, you would hopefully kind of resolve some of the agency issues, right? You kind of set the pattern there of can the state accommodate or can the state exclude these religious agencies? And then I think you're going to have a fair amount of litigation on this issue about what about these individuals? And that might take some time because I think there's just an ongoing enormous debate about gender identity, particularly with respect to, you know, some states are taking an aggressive stance on that in schools, but also in foster and adoption care. So I think it's just going to take some time for those issues to percolate through the system. As you noted, whether it be Blaze, there's another case that went to the Third Circuit that again ruled, it was on a motion to dismiss, but ruled for the foster parents who are excluded because of their religious beliefs about sexual orientation and gender identity. Their foster licenses were revoked. So I think you've got obviously a lot of political pressures on this issue to enforce some, you know, left-leaning policies on pronouns, these type of things. And that's going to work itself out. And of course, even though we're not talking about it, it's similar. It's working itself out in the CPS context and the custody context. You know, that's not something we necessarily directly litigate too much, but it's at stake there. So, you know, I think it's an interesting question of like, what should the standard be in this individual adoption foster context, because as I noted, there's really not that much case law, at least in the federal courts, on this issue besides the cases we mentioned, which is not that much.
Let me ask you a couple of questions we've had come in through the Q&A down at the bottom of the screen, and I'll also use this as a reminder to the audience that if you've got questions, you can go down and click on the little Q&A and submit them, and I think we've got time for a couple here. All right. Would the analysis of this situation be the same if the plaintiff's views were simply based on non-religious moral scruples rather than on religious values? Stated differently, is the religious connection indispensable to your theory of the case and your claims?
Well, it's definitely indispensable to our free exercise claim, which makes sense, right? But not to our free speech claim or compelled association claim. And I think that's one of the reasons why this claim is commonsensically makes sense, because, you know, the state could in theory exclude someone just because they disagree with their political beliefs or want to compel certain political beliefs. And that makes just zero sense, right? I think intuitively, it's like, why would you exclude someone? You know, let's say someone were a communist. Should the government be able to exclude them from this program for holding those beliefs? Or should they say, hey, you have to take your child to whatever political event, religious event, whatever, someone might object to that. And so it, in no ways is our speech claims limited. It is broader, and we think in a good way, because the state shouldn't have this power to exclude anybody categorically like this because of these certain beliefs. Now, and one point I want to raise is, you know, to highlight some of the themes here is Oregon, one of their arguments is, well, we need to categorically exclude you because although you want to raise a child who's under the age of 9, we don't know which child will eventually identify as LGBT. You know, it's unknown. Like in theory, some child might eventually identify as LGBT down the road. Of course, that's also true for religion, right? You know, people convert to different religions all the time. But again, our argument is, you know, that doesn't satisfy strict scrutiny, right? Those are speculative things. And even if you look in the custody context, it's actually interesting. In the custody context, they've evaluated these things, like, for example, a Jehovah's Witness who wants to take custody of a child who, you know, they won't get blood transfusions. And so you have this interesting intersection of how does the court handle that, right? And even in that situation, the court will say, hey, I'm not going to categorically remove custody from you or deny you custody for your religious beliefs on that. I have to, you know, you have to essentially show strict scrutiny and show like, hey, there's a particular child who's suffering from an injury that might make them susceptible, for example, to having a blood transfusion, or we'll wait for a specific situation that it raises. But it goes to the point of highlighting, I think Oregon has really gone too far because they like categorically excluded someone up front, rather than wait for a situation to come up in the back end or place a child on the back end. You know, most of these situations are governed by the best interest of the child. Well, how do we know what the best interest of the child is when we don't know who the child is, right? Because Jessica is excluded from adopting any child. So I think that's just an interesting parallel there.
Let me ask another one from the Q&A. I think you said, early on that at one point Jessica had looked at international adoption. It was prohibitively expensive and there may have been other barriers there. You mentioned too that there are other ways going through a private agency, for example, in Oregon that one can seek to adopt that don't require to interact directly with the state in the way that she is. Like, what's your response to the argument that, like, well, she had alternative avenues that she could have pursued? Why does she want to, why does it have to be this one? What gives her the right to force herself on the state in this way?
Yeah. And it goes to that point of, it's kind of like a tax in the sense of, even when you go through that independent adoption agency, they have higher fees. They put fees on there typically that the state doesn't. And they're also much farther away from Jessica's home where she is. She lives in a rural part of Oregon. So there are not many good options around her. So she has this kind of monetary and practical barriers. You know, the state can't argue, hey, you can get your fire and police services elsewhere, therefore we can condition this benefit on your religious beliefs, so no harm, no foul. That's just not how it works. But it does go to the point, again, highlighting what we've noted is, at the end of the day, the state still has to approve those independent adoption agencies. You know, it goes to the independent adoption, but the state has kind of the final say at the end. So you're still subject to the same rules as well.
Okay. You know, one thing I've learned as a litigator is that whenever it's possible to use fewer pages or fewer words than the court allows you, it's always well received by the audience. And it may be true here that whenever it's possible to use a few fewer minutes than possible, our audience might appreciate that too. We've got a little bit of time left. Let me just ask you this, I guess, as a final question. So we've kind of talked through the facts of this, the claims made, to the legal issues, the relief sought. I guess if you had 2 minutes for at the end of your preliminary injunction argument or to kind of pitch your case, what's your 90-second, your 2-minute closing argument on this that we can take away?
Yeah, and that pitch is really one I've been making, I'm trying to make all along, is the idea of, you know, there's a win-win here for everybody. There's a win-win for people, for the kids, for Jessica and people who share her beliefs. And even for those who are part of the LGBT community, who share different beliefs, whatever, that is not to exclude people from the system upfront because they hold certain views, but to allow them to go through the process and match them at the back end with the child who, you know, works best in their situation. And that way you help the child, you get them, it put them in a loving home. You're not violating anyone's constitutional rights, anyone's right to free speech, religious liberty. I think that's just a win-win for everybody. And that's what helps the kids. It what helps the applicants. It's really what's the best interest of the child. So.
All right. You've persuaded me. Thanks for your time. Taylor, I don't know if you have any closing remarks for us.
I will jump in here. Thank you both, both on behalf of myself and the Federalist Society for joining us today. We appreciate you taking a chunk of your day and gifting us with your time. Thank you also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleforums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.